First case for argument this morning is French against Wachovia Bank. Mr. Hale.
May it please the court. My name is Christopher Hale of Hale & Wagner. Along with my partner, Scott Wagner, who's at council table, we have the honor of representing the Frenches, who are also here today to hear this argument. This case relates to the district court's grant of summary judgment in favor of Wachovia.
So actually, just to be picky about this, if you were to prevail, it's actually at the moment against Wells Fargo, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
Right.
In fact, our representation in the case came when Wells Fargo purchased Wachovia, which created a conflict that Wells Fargo would not waive, and that's our reason for our representation today. The case involves a transaction whereby two life insurance policies in a French trust were converted in a 1035 exchange to two new John Hancock policies. Since this is an appeal of summary judgment, this court, as the district court should have, must review the disputed facts in a light most favorable to the Frenches and all reasonable inferences thereof. On that record, it establishes that this was a self-dealing transaction that resulted in a, at the time, undisclosed amount of commission of $512,000 to Wachovia's subsidiary, Wachovia Insurance Services. It is undisputed that all of the parties to the transaction reviewed the trust and concluded that it did not allow self-dealing and therefore required a written waiver by the Frenches.
Now, I had the impression that before the district court, the theory that was being pushed was slightly different from the theory you're now stressing, that there was some indication that you were arguing, that whoever it was arguing that the language in this trust agreement, which I'm looking at, dealt just with the way these various trusts that the family was creating were going to deal with each other, not the broader point you're making.
It was argued to the district court repeatedly that all the parties to the trust, in fact, did review the trust and conclude the trust did not allow this self-dealing.
And well, I don't think you're quite answering the point that I'm making. Looking at the district court's opinion, it seems to be a different theory that is being urged now. I'll find the exact language in a minute.
I think I understand if I can help then, Your Honor. Yes, indeed, the focus was a little different at the district court, that the language of the trust that Wachovia was asserting post-litigation gave them the right to self-deal was language that was intended to allow the trustee to remain as trustee and deal with other trusts in which he may have a conflict of interest. And that was more of the focus at the district court. But the argument and the fact that all the parties, Wachovia Trust, Wachovia's in-house legal department,
I'm looking at page 18 where it says the Frenches argue that the phrase continuous trustee and to deal with any trust hereunder, the trustee can only ignore conflicts when dealing with separate trusts to be created upon the death of Jim French. It's sort of a more limited idea of conflicts and separate trusts. But I think your problem is basically really just in the language of the agreement. It's not a factual issue.
Your Honor, the language of the agreement is a central issue in this appeal. There is no question. But
and dispositive, I should think. We don't want to have a world in which companies can't go the extra mile, so to speak, without being punished.
I'm not sure what the court is referring
to. Well, what I mean is if the language of the trust says that the trustee can deal without regard to conflicts of interest, then even if the bank was discussing perhaps getting Mr. French's signature. That's what I'm thinking of, is going the extra mile. And it seems odd that you'd want to punish somebody in general. You know, the next bank won't ever ask if that's the rule.
I think the facts are undisputed that they weren't going the extra mile to get that signature. They had concluded it was necessary because of the trust language. That is what
I'm
is
not sure that that's undisputed at all, but the trust language is the trust language.
The trust language is the trust language, but when the court says he went the extra mile, the truly undisputed facts are they had reviewed this trust and they had concluded it was silent.
The point is it doesn't make any difference if the trust language is clear.
If
it doesn't make any difference what spin the parties put on it at the time.
That is correct, Your Honor. Although Welch teaches that you look to the facts and circumstances at the time of the trust creation in determining the meaning of a trust.
Actually, we look to the language first.
Look to the language and also to the facts and circumstances according to Welch. And we can look at the language of this trust and see why it is that this is not the unambiguous and clear language entitling a trustee to self-deal. The district court relied on Welch.
But, you know, you're arguing, think of the broader consequences of your argument. You're arguing that a general statement is never going to be good enough unless it's followed by the legalese that we see in other parts of this trust. When we say without regard to conflicts of interest, we mean no self-dealing, we mean relationships, we mean this, we mean that, we mean the other thing. So you think there always has to be a really long list that elaborates on a general statement?
I don't think it should be a puzzle, Your Honor, where you have to look into the middle of powers and duties where you're not even talking about the transactional powers of a trustee. This is actually fit between setting reserves and distributions. This is language that is nowhere near the transactional language of the powers.
That's because it's a huge list. I mean, you know, if you look at the powers and duties subpart one, without limiting powers, incidental, blah, 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 then there's a long list of things the trustee can do. And I'm going to tell you there's a colon, and then there are a bunch of semicolons, and you finally get to continue as trustee and to deal with any trust without regard to conflicts of interest.
And to continue as trustee, that means he can continue as trustee. There's no reason to put in to continue as trustee if he has the power to self-deal in any transaction. That can simply be stated. To continue as trustee suggests that he's facing a conflict between another trust and he may continue as trustee. And to say, and deal with any trust hereunder, why didn't it simply say, if the court wants language that's broad, this trustee can transact any business at any time without regard to any and all conflicts of interest? That would have been very simple. The concluding language also says, without limitation and of the foregoing. That is all the foregoing. Without limitation of that, all powers are exercised exclusively in a fiduciary capacity. That is language that is governing the language above. There, in a typical case where self-dealing is allowed by a trust, there is specific language allowing it. We've set that forth in the briefs, and I'd be happy to show you that language. But in the powers and duties of trustee, in a form Quarles and Brady document, The broad implication is not, this court says, well, shouldn't there be an allowance for a broad reference to conflicts of interest that would govern all of this? And therefore, you put that in a document, and the duty of loyalty, the most fundamental duty of a trustee, is completely abrogated by putting it in? Well, why
well,
would...
Well, look, I mean, you're overstating it. There are a lot of family trusts where, for the convenience of the parties, there are relaxations of some of the rules that apply to trustees because that facilitates the management of the trust, whereas, you know, maybe other kinds of trusts, they aren't there, but we allow people to relax those rules.
Yes, Judge Wood, we do. And if you look at the case law on that, you will see the distinguishing factor often is independent trustee or a disinterested trustee, as opposed to the Welch case. The settler.
Now, do you know that this commission that WIS got was out of line with market rates?
No, Your Honor. But
So you don't know is what you're saying, or it was not out of line?
There is no evidence either way, Your Honor. The position of the plaintiffs is it should have been disclosed. The amount should have been disclosed so that the Frenches could make a determination.
Well, that's what I don't understand. I don't understand what determination the Frenches had to make. Under trust law, the trustee makes all the decisions. The whole premise of your submission seems to be that the Frenches would decide how the trust assets would be invested. But under the trust instrument, the trustee decides how the trust assets are invested. Don't have any decision to make.
That is correct, Judge Easterbrook. However,
why does one say this information had to be disclosed so that the Frenches could decide when there was nothing for the Frenches to decide?
Two responses, Your Honor. First, the parties had all decided that a written waiver was necessary given the trust language. So in order for the Frenches to decide whether to give a waiver, they needed all the material facts. And one of the material facts is how much money the...
Look, we're back to the Frenches deciding something. If I were a tax collector, I would be tempted to say, in light of all this, that this trust was a sham. As the Frenches depicted, this was no trust at all. The trustee was merely their agent. This was not a trust. There was no real conveyance of the assets to the bank for a decision. And that, I suspect, would have consequences both for income tax and estate tax.
Judge, in a self-dealing transaction, the consent, if the trust does not give the ability of the trustee to conduct that transaction.
Well, we're then back to the question whether this trust instrument allows the bank to engage in self-dealing transactions. If it does, seems to me everything else is gone.
Not everything else, but I will agree with you that is a linchpin of the decision. If the trust document allows self-dealing, then there was no need for the bank to get the consent of the Frenches.
But isn't that what the bank ultimately concluded?
Only after the transaction was concluded and the Frenches would not consent.
Well, so maybe they went back and looked at the language of the agreement and decided that they didn't need to get the consent. That was my comment about the extra mile a little while back.
Well, Judge Wood, it is not consistent with the record because after the transaction was completed, Wachovia and Wachovia Insurance Services both wrote to the Frenches and said...
Look, you keep coming back to this, too. As Judge Wood has said, and I'll say again, and Judge Sykes has said, what the trust instrument does depends on what the trust instrument language says. It doesn't depend on what anybody thought. It doesn't depend on what people said to one another years after the trust was settled. It depends exclusively on what the trust language says. Nothing else matters.
And I did not disagree with you, Your Honor. I was answering...
saying, but the parties assumed X, or the parties said to one another Y. And you've now just agreed with me that that's irrelevant. So why do you keep emphasizing it?
I don't agree it's entirely irrelevant, Your Honor, but I was answering Judge Wood, her question of them going the extra mile, looking at the trust and concluding something else. I was explaining that that is unsupported by the record, which shows that after the transaction, they wrote and again said the trust document was silent.
Well, we're back to what somebody may have thought it means as opposed to what it actually means. It's irrelevant.
It is irrelevant except to the extent, Your Honor, that as a fiduciary, the trustee...
If I were you, in light of the fact that all three judges have told you that this is irrelevant, I would make an argument based on the actual language of the trust instrument.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, on the language of the trust instrument, I would look to the Welch case where it was all the settler, the original trustee, and the beneficiary was the trust, and that there was no independent trustee as there is here. It, often with the language of self-dealing in a trust, the relaxation that Judge Wood referred to, there are exoneration clauses for the trustee, relieving them of any liability at the end of any such power. Here we have just the opposite. The power is governed by the obligation to act exclusively in a fiduciary capacity. And the type of language that has been seen in other cases is also the language that was suggested by the Welch Court, that the language must specifically authorize individuals to borrow money or to purchase money from the trustees. I suggest the Wren's decision is very important to the court's analysis, in that the Second Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the district court's finding that after a trial, that the language had the necessary ability for the trustee to self-deal. And in that case, they also looked at the fact that this was a disinterested trustee, similar to here where it's an independent trustee in the trust document. And the Wrens specifically distinguished the O'Hare-er case. That's O'Hayer. And if the court would like to see language allowing self-dealing, I would suggest that they look at the O'Hare case, where the language of the trust is included in its entirety in the appendix. I would just like to read a little of that language as I'm into my rebuttal time. And we have cited the language, all of the cases that are much more specific than the case here, but the language in the O'Hare case, distinguished by the Wren's Second Circuit Court, is, although it may be a general rule of law that a trustee shall not profit from his trusteeship, I expressly declare and direct that this rule should be completely ignored and set aside in the administration, construction, and interpretation of this trust. Finally, even if the trust document...
That certainly is clear language. What decision do you want to rely on for the proposition that no other language will serve?
We have cited all the language of the cases that have allowed self-dealing that we could find, Your Honor.
Look, listen to my question. A series of decisions say that language X permits self-dealing. The implicit proposition you're advancing is that only the language of prior decisions will do. That is, that it is both a sufficient condition, which is what those cases hold, and a necessary condition. What decision do you want to rely on for the proposition that language like that is a necessary condition?
The Welch case says what is a necessary condition in Wisconsin, Your Honor. The language at issue here is not specific enough. And even if the court found self-dealing was allowed by the trust document, the summary judgment finding was inappropriate because the court found reasonableness as a matter of law. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Raffeld.
May it please the court. As I believe the court appreciates, the trust instrument explicitly authorizes the trustee to both employ brokers and pay their reasonable fees, as well as to act without regard to conflicts of interest.
But what I would like to do is make a textual point for you. This is, I think, trust number one. And there's this long list of things after the colon in subpart one, separated by semicolons, different kinds of powers. One of the powers is to purchase life, liability, and other types of insurance, semicolon, semicolon. And then you come in the middle of it to this phrase, to continue as trustee and to deal with any trust hereunder without regard to conflicts of interest. Well, you're reading this paragraph as though that without regard to conflicts of interest was somehow structurally supposed to reach backward and forward to all of the other powers instead of to be self-contained inside this one clause where it happens to be. So I'd like to know why you think it does move backwards and forwards.
Well, by its very nature, the authorization to continue to deal with the trust or trusts, as the case may be, without regard to conflict of interest, necessarily modifies other actions. It doesn't relate to something in and of itself. It must relate to doing other things.
It's a strange way of putting it, though. I mean, there you are, rolling along through all of this rather turgid prose, and you come to continue. So you're saying that when it says to continue as trustee, ... without regard to conflicts of interest, that somehow colors the entire provision. Isn't that a little strained?
I don't think so. Because it...
Why wouldn't that have gone right at the front under powers and duties?
It could have.
This applies to every power in this list, you know, or something like that.
It could have, but I don't think it has to. And certainly, counsel for plaintiff has cited no case that says that this sort of language, which has no apparent limitations to it, is inadequate. In fact, the cases on which plaintiff relies deal with attempts to imply the right to act under conflicts of interest out of general grants of authority to manage the assets. I think that the language does speak for itself. I would note that counsel's repeated assertions that the parties had agreed that this language requires a waiver is simply incorrect. What happened is that the representatives of the frontline representatives of the trust and the insurance company realized that this language did not fit Wachovia's ideal mold, but ultimately when the legal department took a look at it, they decided that it was not necessary. One way or another, it's all irrelevant. The language of the trust governs. Because the trust language is clear, there really is no reason to go beyond. But if we do go beyond, I would suggest that the authorities, in fact, the plaintiff's own authorities, show that the rule upon which plaintiff relies would not actually apply to this transaction. Now, in plaintiff's brief cites a couple of different authorities. They rely very heavily on Chapter 881 of the Wisconsin statutes for the proposition that there is a duty of loyalty. And they also, in addition to referring to a number of specific articles, refer to an article by Professor Langbein for the notion that the sole interest or per se rule is the most fundamental principle of trust law. Well, interestingly, if you examine the article by Professor Langbein, he notes that an exception that has developed against the per se rule is that the American rule allows trustee compensation, that is compensation directly to the trustee, extending beyond core trustee functions to a variety of settings in which the trustee is allowed to obtain extra compensation for non-traditional services, for example, Ellipses insurance agent. That's on page 977 of the Langbein article. The Langbein article also points out that another exception has developed, and that is where services are obtained through the use of an affiliate rather than the trustee itself. Professor Langbein discusses the Uniform Trustees Power Act, which authorizes the trustee to, quote, employ persons, including attorneys, auditors, investment advisors, or agents, even if they are associated with the trustee. And he cites this as an example of an erosion of the very rule upon which the plaintiffs rely.
So is there any reason to think that Wisconsin has adopted
there
that
is
erosion?
Indeed, at least that provision. If you turn to Chapter 881 and you turn one page past the citations the plaintiff relies on, you see Wisconsin Statutes 881.016, which provides, unless prohibited by the terms of the instrument governing a fiduciary relationship, a fiduciary may employ attorneys, accountants, investment advisors, agents, or other persons, even if they are associated with the fiduciary, to advise or assist the fiduciary in the performance of the fiduciary's duties. Thus, both the trust agreement and the Wisconsin statutes authorize the trust to use and compensate brokers, and both the trust agreement and the statutes authorize the trustee to do so without regard to conflicts of interest. Now, this does not give the trustee carte blanche to go and enrich itself as the expense at the expense of the trust or the beneficiaries of the trust. Rather, it shifts the inquiry to one of good faith. But here there is not a hint of bad faith in these facts. The involvement of the of an affiliate of the bank in this in these proceedings was never a secret. There's absolutely no doubt that both the French's attorneys and Jim French were personally well aware since at least April of 2005, and really much earlier than that, that Wachovia proposed to effect the exchange using one of its affiliates.
So is it your position that Mr. French should have simply asked WIS what its commission rate was? I mean, one of the points Mr. Hale makes is that Mr. French didn't know that it was going to be some $500,000 to effectuate the change, the 1035 exchange. And I guess he didn't know until afterwards, but was this a knowable fact?
We certainly believe it was. We will accept, for purposes of this record, that Mr. French did not, in fact, know, and at least that Mr. Bannon didn't know the precise amount of the transaction. But it is also undisputed, for purposes of this record, that Mr. Bannon himself was an insurance agent, or rather an insurance expert, and that the Wachovia personnel believed he would have known at least of the general order of magnitude. Incidentally, and I would continue with the explanation, but before I forget, Your Honor, counsel for plaintiff said that there is simply no evidence of whether the commission was or was not out of line. That is simply incorrect. The evidence is absolutely undisputed that this commission would have been paid no matter who brokered this transaction.
So what was the form of that evidence?
The form of the evidence was both the testimony of both the declaration and the testimony of Mr. Schumacher, who was the insurance agent, as well as plaintiff's expert, Mr. Witt. Returning to the answer.
A suspicious person would then say the only way anybody could know that was to know that there was a cartel in this business and all the agents were fixing prices. And this price does seem higher than marginal cost.
Well, Your Honor, there has been no antitrust claim brought in this action.
It's just like and, the real estate agents.
and real estate agents do, in fact, receive that sort of compensation. I have to note, and again, I want to finish the answer to your question, but I have to note that we are dealing here with the real world.
In which there are cartels.
But the fact of the matter is that in the real world, insurance companies don't say, you're a trustee, we'll give you a special break. These policies were purchased on the open market. And this was the going rate for the insurance policy. It is undisputed that the same insurance rate, the same commission would have been paid no matter who brokered it, and it would have been the same no matter which insurance company sold the policy. But now to return to your question at long last. We are not contending as an affirmative proposition that Mr. French had a duty to ask, although I think that if he were that interested in the specifics, he or Mr. Bannon probably should have. But the more important fact is that the amount of commission was absolutely immaterial to the analysis, because what happens is that the cash surrender value is paid directly to John Hancock. It is applied pursuant to a formula to the new policies at a reduced accumulated cash value, and John Hancock will then pay the commission. The accumulated cash value and the projection and the premiums, both the premiums and the death benefit established by the insurance contract, are established without regard to the payment of that premium.
Well, I have to say, I can't quite buy the fact that $500,000 floating around there doesn't somehow affect the economics of the transaction, whether it's, you know, oh, don't worry about it, you don't have to reach into your pocket because it's going to come out of the cash surrender value of the other policies, which seems to be what you're saying, or anything else. Sooner or later, it's $500,000 that's going to WIS.
There is no question. But
one thing people could negotiate, unless there is some either regulatory rule or cartel rule against it, is a rebate of the commission.
The
brokers could presumably, even if John Hancock is going to pay them $500,000, brokers could compete for business by promising to rebate part of the commission.
The record is also undisputed that rebates are not permitted.
That is not permitted by state law.
So there's a regulatory ban?
It is, yes, I believe, regulatory and statutory ban. No rebates and no reduction of fees in other contexts.
You're right, of course. I don't want to pursue this antitrust issue too far, especially since under the McCarran-Ferguson Act, it probably doesn't apply to begin with. But.
Okay, and I appreciate that, Your Honor. But again, to answer Judge Wood's question, the fact of the matter is that, you know, is this real money? Of course, it is real money, but there are no options. And even with the payment of this, whether to Wachovia Insurance Services or to some other broker, or even in a world where the insurance company kept it to itself, the fact of the matter is that the trust was better off with this deal than without it. Now, I don't think that there's really any serious question about it, but for purposes of form, perhaps I can go over the merits of the transaction. The fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, this reduced the amount of premiums the trust was paying on an annual basis by $58,000. Those $58,000 can be used by the trust and the trustee to go out and invest in whatever other form of remunerative compensation may be necessary. But it clearly reduced the expense of the sort of asset that we are talking about here, life insurance policies. Now, plaintiffs complain that the loss of the accumulated cash value resulted in a lack of flexibility. Well, first, it wasn't all lost. The vast bulk of it went into the accumulated cash value of the new Hancock policies, although it is true that that cash value would ultimately diminish over time. But a loss, this simply did not harm the trust. Not a single witness has identified any reason why.
Did anybody calculate the net present value of the two forms of policy to the trust?
Mr. Witt, our expert, did so, and that is contained in his report, which is contained in our appendix. And his calculations show that when you take the net present value of the cost as well as the benefit, the trust is about $635,000 better off. Their expert made no such calculation, ignored the death benefit completely, and committed a number of other basic logical errors, all of which are identified in our expert report. But here, there simply is no reason for the flexibility, which is really the one item that they claim we lost. The trust is irrevocable. The trust cannot distribute income or principal until Jim's death. The premiums are amply funded by the remaining assets of the trust. The trust is already diversified. John Bannon, the French's counsel, and generally a skeptic of no-lapse policies, agreed that the ideal purchaser was someone who exactly fit Jim French's characteristics. 75 years old, no difficulty paying premiums, no need for cash value, willing to hold unto death. And moreover, the cash value of the old policies would never have exceeded the death benefit. So there is simply no reason to believe that the trust would ever need or want to call on the cash value of the policies. The highest value would be realized on Jim French's death. District Court, after a full review of the record, determined that the trustees' actions were in good faith, and that determination is fully supported by the record. No one on this record could conclude that it was bad faith to choose to lower the expense of maintaining the same death benefit and giving up a flexibility that the trust simply did not need. If Your Honors have no further questions, I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Gutfeld. Anything further, Mr. Hale?
Yes, Your Honor. Like a lamb to the slaughter, I will come up there.
The importance of the commission is that the Frenches needed to know if they could rely on the independent advice of the trustee, and that advice was tainted by the fact that the affiliate was receiving over $500,000. There were other options available for the life insurance in the trust that was not discussed with them, that would not, that were seen by Wachovia and would not have resulted in a commission to Wachovia. And those were not set forth to the Frenches, and they didn't know about the $500,000 commission, and therefore they could not judge the objectiveness of Wachovia's advice to go forward. The idea that the trust is better off with the new insurance is a matter that is highly disputed. The expert for Wachovia entirely disregarded the cash value and the initial premium of over $800,000 for the new policies. He disregards the $2.2 million cash value. What Wachovia did to achieve the alleged lower premiums is cannibalize the cash value. They surrendered the two policies that had built up the cash value and used the cash value. They say there's no need to use the cash value. They used it to purchase the John Hancock policies and obtain the allegedly lower premiums. But the expert for the Frenches say that if you look at the cash value that was used and calculate that into it, that in fact the new policies are more expensive and less valuable to the trust. And with the expert for Wachovia admits he entirely ignored the cash value and the initial premium that was used from that cash value in coming to his conclusion that the trust benefited by $635,000. If you add the cash value to that, even under Witt's analysis, the new policies cost the trust over $1.6 million over the lifetime of the trust. Bannon's analysis was flawed because he received data from Schumacher, the insurance salesman, that was incorrect. And it is undisputed that data understated the performance of the existing policies in the trust. Regardless...
Thank you, Mr. Hale.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.